Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Tales of the Astonishing Black Spark by Charlie J. Eskew. Narrated by Sean Crisden. Chapter 1. Disassembled.
Superheroes are bullshit. I've been sitting here for half an hour waiting for the rude awakening of my red eye to set in, wondering where to start, and, well, that's what I got. That's the thesis statement. That's what my black ass should have known from years of stroking one out to the fantasy of capes, cowls, colors bright, and spandex tight. I should have just jumped the line to become your cautionary tale sooner. I'm skipping ahead. I was never supposed to be someone, you see. Most people, the untalented people, go off and get a career that doesn't involve chafing and electromagnetism. They might have an origin story, they might get a character arc and a few crossovers, but ultimately, they're supporting characters in someone else's tale. Thanks to, well, we'll get to it. I have to tell you a different story, the one I wasn't supposed to have. This is the story of a man of substance, who had something fantastic, something astonishing happen to him, but who wasn't built to accept it. This is a story of heroes and villains. The kind you got to read about in the comics, but not so much. Yeah, before the Almighty Asper, before the White Flame, before me, all we had were the books. Years of reading Marvel and DC led us to believe that those guys weren't even human beneath the knockoff luchador masks. When I was 8, my dad gave me my first comic book, Wolverine vs. Spider-Man. So badass. You couldn't separate me from that trade. I carried it to every NA meeting he dragged me to, and my pseudo-sister Kat made sure to bring it to me in the hospital after mishaps with rocket skateboards and later, of course, sparks. I ran that fucker through my danger room of a backpack. It was with me from bus stop to bus stop on dark nights and through dead daddies. I knew every page and every detail, every snicket, flip, and bub. The world that existed within those 30 pages always seemed fair. The good guys beat the bad guys, or the bad guys beat the good guys, but you never felt that it didn't make sense. You always knew that somehow, in the end, things happened just the way they were supposed to. This isn't the story of things ending just the way they're supposed to. These are the tales of the astonishing blunders. These are the tales of the astonishing age of heroes. These are the tales of the astonishing world we always wanted. These are the tales of the astonishing world we can't give back. I remember where I was when the Almighty Asper first appeared, as I'm sure most of you reading do, too. I was 15 then, and I was playing a game. By that time, I had my feet firmly sunk in the muck-filled basement that is geek culture, which I would note is a distinct thing from nerd culture. The difference being that while nerds are harassed for unlocking the secrets of the universe, geeks are harassed for rallying to bring back Firefly. So, I was sitting there in the literal basement of the comic book shop playing this geeky game, wowing my buddies with my meticulously crafted versus deck, when there was a shrill sound like stones shredding against plywood. Tremors through the shop shook dust speckles free from the ceiling. Entranced in a miasma of stupidity and curiosity, we, those to whom the earth had been promised, bolted upstairs, leaving our bubble of fantasy to find the store above in shambles. Aiden, the pale, freckled shop owner, had often regaled us with tales of the glory days, the golden age of comics, when heroes were heroes, not like the rubbish they put out now. Silver Age, he would scoff, more like shitty age. After the boom, though, there were no scoffs. There were no debates. There was only a Moffat-inspired silence. There was only me and the other gamers, and Aiden, lying there, but not. His neck twisted around from where it should have been. I waited for a reboot, a retcon, goddamn Dragon Balls, anything that would make sense of it. There were only the pages of ruined stories spilled over him. I screamed. I guess what I'm getting at is that seeing the bludgeoned, ripped, ragged remains of Aiden, his ginger hair twisted darkly by blood, was the beginning of the end for the Golden Age. That place where you find out just how fragile your heroes are. I couldn't look away from Aiden's body. I didn't see what everyone else was seeing. That, of course, being the first ever recorded battle of two talented individuals, Almighty Asper and White Flame. Not that any of those guys knew at the time what the hell was going on. They only knew that he was the answer. He was that fleeting dream that had tucked itself into the corners of their eyes as they spent hours scanning page after page of adventure. He was everything the world needed. He wasn't Aiden. They watched as the 7-foot mass of spandex and caviar dreams brushed glass from his blonde crop of grade A American hair. They were hypnotized by the sight of his scarlet cape, billowing in wind that streamed through the new opening his super brawl with white flame had torn into Aiden's shop. I can only give you a sketch of what happened after that, mostly stuff the guys told me later. In that moment, I forfeited my opportunity to witness the first appearance of the Almighty Asper.
"Who are you?"
one of them asked as the Almighty Asper patted dirt from his blue leggings and cream-colored tunic.
"Me? I, citizen, am the Almighty."
Before he could finish, an elongated tendril sped through the gaping hole and wrapped around the Almighty Asper's head. It dragged him back over gravel and back-stocked milestone comics that had been sitting in the same box for years. The others rushed outside while I tried to take my eyes off of Aiden. I wouldn't find out until later that night, after the coroner had taken Aiden away, when I finally had it in me to go home and watch the news, that the tendril was from the white flame. I guess the reason it's easy to remember the day the first superhero arrived was because it would also prove to be the last day I ever went without seeing that as my image of Aiden. It was the last day I argued with Aiden over who was the best Green Lantern, Rayner, of course, and the last time I walked into a comic book shop in my life. After Almighty Asper and White Flame, spandex would catch on just like any good American fad, and we'd see an overabundance of wild wombats and bold revengers, of ultra-insert names and great what's-his-faces. For the most part, none of them really had what Almighty Asper had, what my agent, Christopher Rowe, would fool me into thinking I had, which he aptly named It. It, for those who don't know, is what makes the difference between having the movie about you made by Scorsese or motherfucking Uwe Boll. But I digress. As I sit here in this coffee shop, I can't turn away from watching you people. You talentless mob. I suppose that I'm one of you now, but I feel like something else entirely. I watch with tear-drunk eyes as you work on your nifty little novel or memoir or poem on your nifty little laptop, and I can't help but wonder why. I can't see it. Nicola says the meaning is there if you look hard enough, past all the bullshit. That between iPhones and WIC cards, there's a silver lining. That something, somehow, connects us all and intertwines everything that we are or will be. But the harder I look, the more convinced I get that it's not there. These are the tales of someone who thought they could see that silver lining. These are the tales of astonishing Saturday mornings and taffy-tickled thumbs. These are the tales of rocket skateboards and gravity's lack of mercy. These are the tales of the astonishing applied uses of misogyny in refrigeration systems. These are... I should really stop beating around the bush. Because my coffee's getting cold and the barista, Tad, I think his name tag said, is starting to give me funky looks and whisper to his co-workers while pointing at me. I'm pretty sure I know what they're saying.
Nah, can't be. But dude, look at his hair. How many black people have white dreadlocks? He could just be a fanboy, some creepy cosplaying fanboy. No, I think it's him, man. I think that's the real Black Spark.
Chapter 2. Origins. Well, we should just get into it. You're probably tapping your finger right now, pissed that I haven't gotten to the whole mass murder thing yet. Don't worry, true believers, we'll get there. You know what, though? Go on ahead if you want. I'll even give you the title of the chapter. The night everything changed. There. If you're so invested in the moment I became the deviously dark spark, skim on over. But I'd like to begin with a time not so beaten and bronze. We'll begin with the boom. I'm Donald, by the way, though you've probably gathered that already. I looked for myself online the other day as the Black Spark. With this cluster of collectible catastrophes being my life and all, I get curious to see what you all are saying about me. When the screen returned, "Did you mean Donald McDougal?" I deduced just how utterly screwed I am. Anyway, where was I? Oh yeah, boom.
The A&E biopic, A Spark of Courage, the inspirational tale of the world's first African-American Negro-Black superhero, wasn't exactly spot on. The story doesn't start with me doing work with the Peace Corps in Africa. It starts with me and a toilet, fighting a losing war in my throat, crouched over a bowl at Paul Hughes' New Year's Eve party. The sounds of everyone outside the bathroom mixed into an amalgam of empty promises and drunken vows for the upcoming year. Thunder rattled the window. It was a weirdly warm December night. I guess the weather gods were displeased. I was busy vomiting what looked like trail mix when I heard a pounding at the bathroom door. This was followed by a jiggle of the handle. I bumped away from the toilet to the flat of my ass. "Give me a minute," I gathered they couldn't hear me as the jiggling and pounding continued. After the 10th attempt, I lunged for the door handle and unlocked it. Paul, my brother from another, burst in. I gave my best "I'm okay" smile, but it didn't really work, since the trail mix had spilled down my tie. Paul quickly made sure that no one else was around, shut the door, and crouched down in front of me.
"You're a mess."
"You're a dick,"
I said, with a laugh that nearly lurched what remained in my throat up the pipe. Paul scratched at his clumped beard. I felt his hand reach the underside of my arm, coiling tight against the tweed blazer, and I jerked away.
"I want to sit here for a while."
I wiped his toilet seat clean with my forearm, ever the courteous Lush. The outsiders persisted with their knocking until Paul kicked against the door.
"One minute, fucking hell!"
The voices stopped and feet trailed away. He turned back to me, shifting some dreadlocks away from my face and tucking them behind my ear. My reluctant hero surveyed the area, paying a sigh to every spot of chaos I'd caused, though I knew he could afford it. There was a shattered frame covering an artsy photo of an opium den. Sigh. Potpourri spilled from a wicker basket, trailing towards me. Sigh. One best friend with a blazer between barfs. Sigh.
"The ball's about to drop. New year, new possibilities, all that."
I almost projectile vomited again when Paul grabbed me beneath my arms, but I fought it. After sloshing to my feet, I snapped away from him. The shift so sudden, his ankh necklace swayed.
"I got it,"
I said, straightening my jacket.
"Yeah, you got it."
While I, as you heard, had it, he still waited a few moments before opening the door. The party was too busy to notice anything beyond the sounds of slushed say-say, magical incantations like conscious rap and, well, NPR said. I leaned against the kitchen sink. Paul grabbed a beer from the fridge.
"So, is Thandi coming?"
I asked. Paul draped his arm over my shoulder in his best attempt at a bro hug. It had been about a week or so at that point since she'd left me nearly naked in her living room, with 10 Things I Hate About You playing on her flat-screen TV. Joseph Gordon-Levitt's proclamations about being back in the game will forever remind me of getting dumped.
"What do you do when you lose the woman of your dreams?"
I turned to look Paul in the eye, but the furthest I got was the top of his tie.
"You wake up, I guess."
"Yeah, I guess."
I whipped my head up and stared at the ceiling to avoid drowning in all the feels. Eventually, after a chuckle from Paul, I splashed a bit of cold water over my face. Paul handed me the dish towel and patted my back. He walked me back into the living room with everyone else. His iPod seemed to have forgotten there was anyone in hip-hop beyond Badu or Common. No one seemed to mind, though. Hakeem, one of Paul's co-workers, was the first to notice me and waved, making everyone else turn, too. I froze. They froze. I tried to save the day.
"Zappity-doo!"
I crowed, making a show of accidentally straightening my vomit tie with my bare hand. There were chuckles, a few O'Donalds. I tipped my invisible hat and stumbled toward the couch, making certain to trip over my own foot. It's the details, true believer. They laughed. I shuffled over the speckles of pride I'd left lying on the ground, heroically pulling myself up to the couch and flopping down on it. Paul didn't laugh. He summoned his best Lawrence Fishburne face and sat down on the other side of the room. These are the astonishing tales of John Singleton's sorrows.
"I think Gravitina is doing the ball drop this year,"
someone said.
"No, I think it's Death Rage this year."
"Wasn't he banned after the whole accidentally shooting into the crowd thing?"
"There was no indictment. I saw it the other week."
"No, no, it has to be Almighty Asper. He does that thing with his freaking laser eyes and smaboosh, the ball turns into a million pieces and, like, snows down over the crowd."
"A million pieces of glass sounds kind of not like a good idea,"
I say. But they don't hear me. To them, I'm just Paul's drunk friend, the relic of his yesteryears and cultural irresponsibility.
who probably has an entry-level job and works next to Letitia in the sky with cubic zirconium. As the countdown continued, thunder boomed outside. There was a flash of light, and then everything went black. The 45-inch plasma screen shut down along with the rest of the power in the house. A chorus of awe and no and what the actual fuck, man, filled the air. Now's my chance, I thought. While everyone griped and Paul yelled back, letting them know he was going to fix everything like only he could, I seized the moment and escaped into the black. So, yeah, it was a stormy night. You know, the kind where lightning strikes. If I'd only remembered my wallet and cell phone, I'd probably have called a cab. Or cat. And I might not be here in this cafe, chugging down this overpriced Verona blend and telling you this story. I would have gone back to Paul's house the next night for his New Year's Day party, and he would still be trying to save me. I cursed at the unseasonable rain, sniffling as I shuffled. I needed to breathe. I needed to feel the cold and the fury and the bite. What I really needed was another fucking drink. Without my wallet, I had to walk from Bexley, a neighborhood of blocks bagels and brick buildings, through downtown Columbus, Ohio, filled with A&B coin and liquors and a legion of hair salons, to my one-bedroom apartment on 21st Street. Drivers passed me and honked, but I wasn't stupid enough to flip them the bird. My black and dreadful locks were soaking up water and weighing my head down. I was wobbly and cold. I was thirsty, but not for water. I was thirsty for Thandi. I was thirsty for my rocket skateboard and the push, even the fall. There was another boom of thunder. It wouldn't be long, but I couldn't know that. I was thirsty to be naked with clothes. Another boom. I was thirsty to know what you probably already do. Another boom. I was thirsty for nothing. Another boom. A flash. A spark. Chapter 3. The Lightning Saga. May 18th. The Superpower Hour with Keith Kelly Kerskovich, Hound News Station. It was a close one, that's for sure. Thankfully, I'd soon get a spark to my system. When I said it, I turned to the camera and let some sizzling electricity bounce around the copper emblem of my costume.
That's amazing. No, astonishing.
Laughter.
So, after you saved the chief's daughter, what happened next?
Keith was sitting on the edge of his seat. I waited a moment, just like Chris had told me. Good, that was good. Be approachable, be funny, be everything they need you to be, he'd tell me after the interview. Well, they just sort of stared at me. Keith, still on the edge of his seat, gave a knowing shake of the head. So, I'm losing a lot of blood. I won't go into the details, but it wasn't a pretty sight. And they bring me to their shaman, this hulking, beastly figure of a man. I was afraid at first, like anyone would be. He was like a hybrid of nightmare and beauty, his body riddled in tribal markings I couldn't understand and didn't try to, since the pain from the attack was radiating through me. He put a hand on me, and another, to the sky. The rest was kind of a blur. He started to convulse, which really freaked me the hell out, to be honest, man. But then, in a sudden burst, this light beamed over me, a gentle stream of pure, powerful lightning coiling around my body. It was then that I was reborn as the Spark.
That is truly a harrowing story, so dignified. And if I may say, you are just so well-spoken.
Oh, well, thank you, Keith. Thank you very much. I must have told that story 1,000 times by then. Each time I did, I believed it all the more. January 1st, 1:53 a.m., Spirit Hospital.
Crash cart, goddammit!
I wish I could give you a clear recollection of what happened in the hospital that night, or even those first few weeks. But I'm surprised I remember anything at all, aside from the smell of burning cotton and the stinging of bright fluorescent lights.
Ah, soiled himself. That fucking smell. Insurance? ID?
I'd be told later about the thrashing, about the sedation that didn't sedate, about the absolute resistance of my body.
Only on News Channel 8. Coffee later? Patient's name is Donald McDougal? Nurse!
I'd be told later that America averages 120 to 125 lightning-related accidents each year.
Emergency contact, Paul Hughes.
I'd be told later that of these lightning attacks, about 90% involved serious injury. Decreased quality of life, paralysis, nerve damage, scarring, but not the cool kind.
$20 says, 8 weeks already, wasting good taxpayer, like Obamacare.
I'd be told later that the other 10% are fatal.
Can you hear me, Donald? Christ, Donald, just wake up!
I'd be told that after racking up $800,000 in medical bills, I beat the odds. I was a miracle. God had a plan for me.
Perfect. He'll do perfect.
I'd be told that the local news station had screwed up and displayed my picture at about 3/5 the size it was supposed to during the report of the accident, so no one saw me. No one except Paul.
Integration complete.
I was told someone was looking out for me. I was told I had a hero. When I finally came back, it wasn't in the middle of the road like I expected. It was in the peaceful dark of my hospital room. I knew it was a hospital because you always know it's a hospital when you've watched someone close to you die in one. What I didn't know was how I'd gotten there. I remembered the power going out and staggering out of Paul's, but not much else. The only thing that came through clearer than Paul's party was the pain. I remembered the sensation of skin tearing, a steel porcupine tumbling down my spine, settling atop my heart, tiny pins poking over and over, never stopping. I began screaming. I twisted. I coiled. I sparked. The hairs on my chest, pallid white, trembled against the ECG electrodes with the low, humming whisper I'd soon come to know so well. The lights on the attached monitor began flickering. I remembered lying in bed with Thandi on a Thursday morning, teasing the curtains open to wake her with spurts of sunlight. I remembered falling from a skateboard and being rushed into a hospital that blinked incessantly with fluorescent bulbs, a mess of 10-year-old blood beneath white sheets. I remembered licking batteries through the small gaps of freshly fallen baby teeth and fiddling at electrical outlets with forks. I'd surged. That's what Nicholas would call it later on. Everything was burning, but nothing was on fire. I felt my muscles contract and release. I was the boy who'd been struck by lightning. I'd come back. But I'd come back wrong. Contract and release. The ECG machine smoked and popped. Contract and release. A nurse rushed in, but I couldn't hear what she said over the buzzing and throbbing in my ears from that first surge. She touched me and got catapulted back, slammed into the wall. I squeezed my eyes shut. Contract and release. I slipped into unconsciousness. When I awoke, it was to the familiar smell of cherry coke and clove cigarettes. Turning my head, I blinked the fuzziness away and saw Kat, her short blob of straight black hair hanging eerily over one of her eyes, emo style, though the blonde roots kind of ruined the effect. I thought of high school days, hanging out in the bathroom, sitting on a closed toilet lid while Kat cursed and hair dye drizzled down over her eye. Kat was my oldest friend. I guess I'd grown closer to Paul over time, but she and I had always been there for each other when it counted. She slept soundly, curled up in a thin ball on a chair with hands cradling her knees. My throat was painfully dry, but it had nothing on my lips, so I decided not to talk. I just let her sit there sleeping. When I felt a bit calmer, I shuffled myself to the bathroom. I cupped water in my hand, splashing it against my face. I guess by this time I'd developed some pain tolerance, because even though it bit my skin, I didn't freak out like I had earlier. I just reached for a towel blindly, like it was shampoo in my eye. I threw the towel to the side and opened my eyes to see a stranger in the mirror. Well, okay, maybe stranger is a bit dramatic, but that's how I felt when I saw my dreadlocks transformed into a bounty of snowy tendrils. "What the hell?" I said aloud. If there's a checklist of superhero habits, talking to yourself has to be on there somewhere. I once attributed it to lazy writing in the comics when you saw super whoever speeding across the sky with speech bubbles instead of thought bubbles. Conversing with themselves about whatever catastrophic event they were on their way to stop. The bad comic writers had it right, though. I stared for what felt like forever into my own eyes in the mirror. They'd shifted to a silvery hue from the brown I'd always known. Is this supposed to happen? I ran my fingers through my hair. At first, I tried to deduce who around my comatose body would go through the trouble of dyeing my hair white. Would Kat or Paul? But it was the same on my arms, my body, my legs. For good measure, I locked the door and took off the hospital gown, only to see more snow in the south of the garden. A long scar wrapped around my left shoulder, traveling diagonally across my body like an off-kilter ring of Saturn. Even weirder, This body had to belong to someone who hadn't smoked a pack of cigarettes a day or spent their Sunday afternoons watching reruns of Gilmore Girls, a show about cars, while inhaling microwavable burritos smothered in lard. I touched the pack of muscles that had somehow snuck their way into my abdomen in place of the charming beer belly. My arms, my legs, everything. I belonged on one of those workout videos that told you over and over how much better you could be if you just fought the urge to do nothing.
Donald, are you in there?
I scrambled to put the hospital gown back on.
One sec,
I said, trying to be loud enough for her to hear me, but only managing a raspy whisper. Before I was even one step out of the bathroom, Kat pounced on me, laughing.
How are you feeling?
She said.
I don't know, but I guess pretty good, all things considered.
It wasn't the first time Kat had seen me in a hospital bed, but at least this time it was the universe and not some childish flight of fancy that had put me there.
Dude, you were struck by lightning,
she finally said over a huff of laughter. A few dewy drops welled up in the corners of her eyes, but she was too stubborn to let them fall. One wrong word and I knew she would make this one of the awkward moments we always tried to retcon in the history of us.
I know, right?
I said. I guess I'll spare you the next 15 minutes of us going back and forth, the oh my gods and you're so luckies. It's enough that you know they were there, I guess.
How long have I been here? The last thing I remember is Paul's party.
It was weird, Kat. I remember voices. I remember waking up for a minute hooked up to machines, hearing Paul and a few other things.
It's been a while, about 2 months. The doctors say it was touch and go for a long time. Paul's been coming in almost every other day to hang out with you, and I try to make it up here when I can. He'll be pretty pissed I was here for the big wake-up scene, and he wasn't.
I almost made the mistake of placing my hand over hers, breaking her cardinal no-touchy-less-you-want-destroy-ye rule, but a familiar flame in her eyes stopped me.
Don't get weird about it, she said.
It's really awesome that you're here, Kat. Thanks.
Well, I'm really, really glad you're not dead.
They released me about a week later with a clean bill of health, or at least as clean as I was going to get without insurance. Paul drove me home, not wanting me to hoof it for fear of another lightning attack, in the middle of a sunny March afternoon.
So how does it feel to get back to the world?
He asked.
Surreal.
I'd been staring out the window at everything scattering like fading lines on an etch-a-sketch.
Guess that's to be expected. You were struck by lightning. You survived. Your black ass survived. Hell, I have half a mind to write a piece about you.
I didn't die. The whole survive thing is still up in the air. A group of kids threw a ball back and forth from opposite curbs while we sat at a red light.
It's nice to know this hasn't messed up your ability to rain on a parade,
Paul said, rolling his eyes so hard that I didn't have to look over. I just felt it.
I have 2 months of rent to catch up on, a migraine, and a pound of hospital meatloaf in my stomach that isn't going to come out without a fight, not to mention the bills that are going to start floating to my mailbox any day now. You decided to bring your parade through my shitty little village.
The light turned green and everything moved without moving again.
I didn't know why Paul would want my story for his online magazine, blog, the Kumba Collective. They mostly published political stuff, anti-establishment rhetoric, and he received enough side-eye as a young editor who was relatively successful, so it didn't seem like veering off into a fluffy piece about an uppity retail worker, who happened to be his best friend, should appeal. I eventually settled on telling him that I'd consider it, just to prevent him from giving his usual speech about how everyone has a story that needs to be told. I also kept the bit about the ECG machine and the whole nurse electrocution thing to myself. Thankfully, she was fine, save for a bitch of a headache and some admittedly convenient short-term memory loss. I wanted to tell him. If you decide to pick this up, Paul, I really wanted to tell you. It wasn't a lack of trust, man. I just had enough to deal with. When the hospital chalked up the ECG busting to faulty mechanics, I figured it best to let you keep thinking that. Looking back, it'd probably have been nice if you were there at my side for this next bit. At my shoebox of solitude, there weren't any streamers or noisemakers, no Thandi D. Nettle lingered, and my beautiful believers didn't exist yet. What I did find were empty cupboards and a cloud of buzzing black gnats swarming over the now fungus-encrusted bowl of microwavable pad thai that sat on my Craigslist coffee table. The electricity had been shut off. I'd expected as much, though. Paul made it his mission per usual to save me, trying to drag me from the beautiful dark of my apartment to his townhouse with the always open doors. It's one thing to deal with a little darkness.
It's a whole other thing to deal with a constant stream of guests discussing the black plight of the new millennium. No thanks, I'm good, I told him. Kat made a similar offer, but she basically lived in a shoebox also, and squeezing anyone else into it would be an exercise in defying physics. When I returned to the
Sample complete. Ready to continue?